Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Thank you for welcoming me here to Bayonne, France. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. And thank you very much for the warm welcome I've received here. I'm going to talk briefly about innovation in education technology. The subject of the conference, of course, and I noticed the slide earlier asked whether resistance is futile. I'll address that a little bit. I want to talk about what innovation is. I want to talk about the factors involved in innovation. I want to talk about how we use our understanding of innovation to assess and evaluate new technologies and new trends in education. Because I think that innovation is not something we should accept simply unquestioningly. Innovation is something that can be a benefit to us or perhaps not a benefit to us. And I think we have both the right and the obligation to participate fully in innovation for our own sake and for the sake of our students. Speaking of which, I'd like to welcome the students who are here in the room practicing the craft of journalism. This is something that I used to do when I was their age, and it's something that will serve them well for the rest of their lives. So welcome. New computer, getting used to it. So what is innovation? You can read quite a bit about it, especially in management and business literature or in the Telegraph, which is where I took some of my quotes. People talk about innovation as creating value from ideas. They talk about innovation as something fresh, new, inspired, but they say always that innovation is more than just coming up with the idea. Innovation is something that addresses specific challenges, and most importantly, especially when you're talking to business and management professionals, it creates value or benefit. And it's funny, I've worked with managers a lot over the years in my work with the National Research Council of Canada. And the first line that comes out from the innovators, the people who want to commercialize something, is they say, well, anyone can come up with an idea. That's really easy. But the hard thing, they say, is to execute that idea, to turn that vision into a reality. As someone whose job it is to come up with those ideas, I question that assertion. I think it's hard to come up with ideas. It's easy to come up with ideas. It's hard to come up with good ideas. That diagram there, that's from Yale. You can't read it, but don't worry about it. It's their process for looking at and assessing whether or not to proceed forward with an idea. It is not easy to come up with good ideas. And it's not necessarily the case that the idea that you come up with that will be turned into a business innovation will be something that generates value. Here's some typical examples of innovations: the iPhone, Tesla. Perhaps some of you are old enough that you remember the Pet Rock, which created millions of dollars for its inventors. For those, yeah, I see some of you younger people shaking your head. This came out in, I think it was the 70s, only something that could come out in the 70s. They took rocks, ordinary rocks, they put them in a box, and they sold them. That's it. That's the innovation. Fangster is something that we have today. It's more recent. It's a service that will provide personal thank you notes for all your friends so that you don't have to. Underneath the diagram there, again, we've changed computers, so there's some formatting issues. Uber is an innovation, I guess. Airbnb or Bodega. If you're wondering what Bodega is, it's that thing on the right. Basically, it's a vending machine. You know, we have to ask, when we're talking about innovation, producing value, value for whom? And what is value, really? Is value defined as anything for which customers will pay? You know, there's up in Davos, there's a whole bunch of people who think that's value. Is value something that must satisfy a specific need, something that we will address with user stories and case studies? Is value customer-based? When we think of innovation in the classroom, does that mean we take the perspective of students as customers? I think these are hard questions. What are the factors that motivate innovation in our classrooms, in education technology, in the system generally? And what is the outcome of this? Is it, as this diagram suggests, some sort of programmed learning so we can innovate ourselves out of a job? Is it something that automates the process, the whole process of learning, so it's fast and easy? I'm not sure. In recent history, there has been a lot of innovation in education technology. We've gone from the learning management system, which originally was developed as a way to create course tools, one of the original learning management systems called WebCT, that actually stood for Web Course Tools. And it was like grade books and assignments and notes for instructors. And we've gone from that to today, the massive open online course. In the process of this, we got things like learning objects, which are small pieces of digital content intended to be put together, mixed and matched with each other in order to form learning opportunities. We got learning content, and for many years, content was king. We got open educational resources, and for a time, for about a decade, actually, people thought of innovation in educational technology as taking the course, taking the textbook, and replicating that format in a digital environment. That was innovation. But over time, people took a hold of that and they converted open educational resources from things that we use to teach other people to things that we use to exchange concepts and ideas with each other. We transformed the innovation into something else for ourselves. And of course, we have the MOOC, the massive open online course. The MOOC was developed as a way of using open educational resources in order to provide learning, not necessarily more effectively or more efficiently, but more to create access to online learning for people who did not previously have access. And it was a way of creating a mechanism of offering online learning such that each individual attending the MOOC could participate in the creation of their own education. It was very important to us who worked on MOOCs that they be open, freely accessible, that they be online so they could be accessible anywhere. The massive and the course part, that was almost an accident. But with the MOOC, we didn't want to offer a course per se. We wanted people to be responsible for their own education. And our purpose in offering the MOOC was to try to help them to make that possible. So we set up a scaffold that enabled people to bring their own resources to communicate with each other, to define what it was they wanted to learn, and to manage the learning for themselves. This did not last very long. The MOOC, as we know it today, is now what I call the ex-MOOC. And it is a traditional course, like a textbook, that has been placed online and made available to, well, hundreds of thousands of people. The ex-MOOC, offered by universities like Stanford or MIT or Harvard, or companies like Coursera, Udacity, and others, depend mostly on pre-recorded videos, pretty much gave up on community, created resources and assignments centrally, and then over time, because they started out open, but over time, converted the open online course into a commercial product, thereby producing value for money. So, was that innovation? I'm not sure, but the MOOC today has transformed education to a significant degree. These are numbers from Class Central from this year. People say the MOOC is dead. 78 million students, more than 800 universities, more than 9,000 courses online. So I think that the original idea of the MOOC did capture something that was wanted, but it also got transformed in the process. So I have mixed feelings about innovation. I've thought about innovation quite a bit over the years. What creates innovation? What causes innovation? What causes change? Well, this is the model I work with. It's a pretty simple model. It's nothing really complicated, but it's important to draw out the different aspects or factors involved in innovation. There are drivers on one side, attractors on the other side, and both of these contribute to the movement or the change that constitutes the innovation. By drivers, what I mean is a force that operates on schools or on society, pushing us toward change. Drivers are what we hear a lot about when our managers talk about innovation. Drivers include factors ranging from demographic change to economic restraint and everything in between. Let me look at a few of these. Costs. That's a major driver. We must reduce expenses. We must increase revenue. We need to do more with less. That's a very commonly expressed driver. I hear that all the time. Those of you who are in your own work environments probably hear this all the time as well. Events are major drivers. That's something called Sputnik. Sputnik was a satellite launched by the Soviet Union the year before I was born. And in the United States, at least, and I guess overlapping into Canada and possibly Europe, it created this urgent need to develop scientists and engineers in order to catch up to the Russians. And we were into the space race. The external event of the launch of Sputnik created a driver for change. Crises. We've all seen crises of one sort or another through our lives. The events of 2001 in the United States created an urgent need in that country for change. And they created a lot of change in the years that followed. Invention. People always say it's not about the technology, it's all about the pedagogy. But that's not true. Invention is a major driver of change. If you think about it, you think through history, the invention of the automobile, the invention of the atomic bomb, the invention of the bayonet, local reference, all of these changed history, and they were drivers for change. Growth, demographic change. How often have you heard that our society is getting older, there are fewer and fewer young people in proportion, and therefore our educational system must change to adapt to this need? Sounds familiar? These are all drivers. These are all forces pushing us to change. But I want you to observe some things about drivers. First of all, they are almost always presented as inevitable and irresistible, like the onset of mobile technology and phones ringing. Something that we cannot escape. Drivers are almost always external. They're not something that happens within our organizations or even within our own lives. They're factors from outside coming in and pushing us forward. They tend to be constant. There's never going to be a shortage of drivers. No matter what we do today, tomorrow, there will be new drivers pushing us towards new changes. This has always been the case, and it always will be the case. If there is one constant in human history, it is change. But most significantly, and I think that this is a key awareness that we need to take home with us, drivers are directionless. They don't push us in any particular direction. You say there is a crisis. Well, okay, we need to change, but how? The crisis doesn't tell us how. We have demographic issues. Okay, we need to change, but how? The issue doesn't tell us how we need to change. The driver itself does not define the need for the innovation. It just pushes us, but it pushes us blindly. The other side that is equally, if not more important, is what may be called the attractor. I'm borrowing the term from physics and from chaos theory, and I mean it in kind of the same way. An attractor is a factor that defines what we want to accomplish through what we are doing, in our case, through education. These are factors that may range from self-improvement to workplace training or whatever. I'll talk about a few of these. The attractors express what we want as an outcome of our innovation. When we talk about an innovation is not just an idea, but it has to provide a benefit. The attractor tells us what counts as a benefit and what does not. It creates some issues, though. If we say, you know, we're going to benefit, or that there will be a benefit as a result of the innovation, then how do we define this? It implies a directionality, but there are different ways of creating directionality. often you'll hear about things like systems thinking and the educational organization as a system. And that implies a predefined outcome. Systems have purpose. But more and more, in our schools and in our society, we're adopting the structure of a network. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But the main thing here is that a network does not have a purpose. If you think about it, you know, it's like the difference between a company and a city. A company has a purpose. It's a system. Its purpose is to make money. But a city doesn't have any particular purpose. There's not a reason everybody comes together to form a city. Each person in the city has their own interests and their own ambitions and their own objectives. The city is a network, a way of cooperating so that each of us can produce our own individual benefit. So when we talk about innovation, we have to talk about some key core questions. Who or what is the benefit intended to benefit? When we innovate, are we focusing on supporting the benefit of government, supporting the benefit of a company, supporting the benefit of people? And what is the benefit? Is it a good that is produced, but do we think of ourselves as producing graduates? That doesn't really ring right, does it? Do we think of ourselves as producing degrees or certificates? That doesn't seem right either. What about maybe we produce jobs and prosperity? But no, I think as educators, we don't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to go to the office and produce some jobs. I don't think that's what we do. What are the benefits? Well, we try to address basic human needs, right? So, you know, physiological needs, safety, security. These are certainly attractors. These are things that people work toward in their lives. Of course, what counts as a need, well, we might argue about that. Here's another type of benefit, the values that we hold. Some of us value education and learning for its own sake. Some of us work toward religious or spiritual objectives. Some of us are just interested in development, developing ourselves, developing society. Others are interested in compassion and healing. That characterizes many people in education and also in the health professions. And some people just want to share. These are all values that are expressed. Attractors. The attractors are often in our lives defined by the models or the images that are presented to us. I thought about this. In different times through history, people have wanted to be different things. When I grew up in the 1960s, everybody wanted to be a scientist. It was the Sputnik effect, right? And we read science fiction, and we dreamed about rocket ships and slide rules and modern technology like space boots. That was good stuff. In the 1970s, people wanted to be like O.J. Simpson or Michael Jordan. I guess it's too early for Michael Jordan. Athletes, or maybe an activist like John Lennon. We like John Lennon. In the 1980s, bankers and investors, everybody wanted to make money. They wanted to be in finance, foreign exchange. In the 1990s, the models were celebrities. We wanted to be famous. That's still true today. More recently, we look at entrepreneurs as the models of virtue in our society. Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, even today, what's his name? Elon Musk. And 2010's the startup. We're in startup culture. Our heroes are people who built something from nothing, so they say. Different models over different time create different values, create different definitions of the benefits. And it's interesting, and you know, outside the scope of this talk, how easily that's manipulated. Goals are attractors. People say, you should go to school, we should design our education system to produce jobs, prepare people for jobs, for training. But I don't think people are really looking for jobs. They're looking for sustenance, sure. A job is the way they get that. But, you know, I don't think people actually want jobs. Other people's goals may be fame, fortune, or perhaps something closer to home, the success of their family and their children, or perhaps preserving heritage and culture. There's a lot of attractors. The things to notice about attractors is they are personal and individual. What motivates you is different from what motivates the person next to you. What defines the good for you is different from what defines the good for the person next to you. They're not always rational. The great failure of economic theory in the 20th and early 21st century is the presumption that people act rationally. Why would we do that? Why would we act rationally? Very often, acting rationally is the most irrational thing we can do. Attractors depend a lot on models and examples of exemplars. As Gandhi, so they say, used to say, be the change you want to see in the world. That is this principle in operation. Creating a model or an example that later becomes the benefit that other people want to emulate. And they are variable. They change like the wind. They are what are sometimes called strange attractors. The random walk. From one day to the next, what motivates you toward change, toward innovation, is going to change itself. It creates a fundamentally chaotic system that we're working in. So, let's look at this from a little bit of perspective. When we're looking at change, especially in educational technology, especially in our schools, we need to look at it from the perspective not only of drivers, but also of attractors. Not only of the forces that push us, but also toward the outcomes that are the benefits that we want to obtain ourselves. So I'm going to step quickly through some of the innovations that we've been talking about in recent years and think about these briefly just in terms of drivers and attractors, and I invite you to do this as we go along. So here's a bunch of things that have been presented over the last year or two as the new changes in education. Learning analytics, for example. Social networks, discourse analysis, predictive modeling, semantically defined curricular resources, etc. Using artificial intelligence to plan and deliver education. So, is this an innovation? We talk about, for example, predictive analytics as though the benefit we will derive is people will finish the course. We can predict whether they'll fail and we'll help them finish the course. But is that really what the person wants? Is that really the benefit to the person? Or is the benefit to the person more like getting feedback on their own performance so that they can meet their own objectives? The course is just a tool. Personalized learning, you've probably heard a lot about personalized learning, adaptive learning, user models, and all of that. A lot of personalized learning is based on the idea that if we just knew enough about the person, we could find exactly the right educational resource for them and arrange these in personally defined sequences. But is education a search problem? Is education really a question of finding the right resources? From my perspective, I see more value, more benefit created when people create their own resources and define their own learning. We hear a lot about the Internet of Things and mobile technology. Here's a few examples. A person who built a face-recognizing doorbell, there's value for you. Your doorbell will tell you who's at the door, or you could open the door. Or how about this? It's called the Magic Band, of course. When you go to Disneyland or Disney World, you put it on your kids. It will track your kids. It will admit them to rides. It will let them spend money without ever touching money. Is that a benefit to you, to your kids, or to Disney? Performance support. We hear a lot about performance support, but we don't really know what it is. We think of performance support as though it's like a computer dashboard. But if we think about benefits and what people really want, it's performance support in the appliance that they're actually using. This is a tennis racket. It's kind of whited out, but it's there. It teaches you how to play tennis. It connects to your phone. You swing, your phone tells you what you're doing wrong. Credentials. Again, this is something that we've been hearing quite a bit about recently. The use of blockchain, which is a cryptographic technology to encode credentials so that people can't fake their college or university degree. And these are being extended to something that are called micro-credentials, so that we have small individual credentials that are what they call stackable. So you get credential after credential after credential, you stack them up, and eventually you have a whole degree. Why would they do this? Why did the existing system of credentials not work? Well, you can see it right here. To be profitable, privatization depends on standardization to scale. The micro credential is standardization to scale. We see in the United States something called competencies and skills system. This is designed by Advanced Distributed Learning for the U.S. military. And it defines all the competencies of different occupations. And by doing this, they create corresponding learning objects, which we talked about earlier, and organize them. And we create corresponding assessment objects so that the competency defines the skill, defines the resource, defines the assessment. It's like a thread running through the educational activity. And, you know, it's funny, I get different reactions to this idea depending on different audiences that I talk to. I expressed skepticism about this idea to an audience, and it was an audience of military and corporate trainers, and they said, well, why are you being skeptical about this? This is exactly what we want. We want to standardize corporate training. But is it what the people working in the corporation want? How do you define that? How do we build this assessment system in any case? How do we design a system where the incentives and the motivations are toward honest and credible assessment rather than a mechanism that allows students to figure out how to game the system? Right now, we create incentives for dishonest academic behavior because it's about getting the credential or the certificate. How do we create incentives for honest academic behavior? I think of this in terms of learning outcomes, not in terms of tests, credentials, or anything like that, not in terms of the things produced by the educational system, but rather in terms of things produced by the students themselves. I look at what a person is doing, what they're creating, what they're talking about, what they're sharing with the rest of the world, and in that overall behavior, I'm able to recognize whether they have learned, whether they have achieved. And I find that more of an authentic kind of assessment than micro-credentials, badges, certificates, or anything like that. That, to me, would be an innovation. We have learning tools interoperability, which is allowing our programs to interoperate with each other so that our learning management system can launch, say, a virtual reality. And we have games and gamification. So these are elements that turn learning from a mechanism for achieving the benefit that we want to a mechanism for achieving points. And again, I ask, where is the innovation here? How are we creating benefit? If we think the core problem is motivation, then this produces a benefit. And some of you may feel that this is the core problem. If, by contrast, you feel the core problem is authentic learning, then turning learning into a game might not be considered an innovation. Similar statements could be made about immersive reality. Similar statements could be made about translation and collaborative technology. Similar statements could be made about cloud infrastructures, VMware, Amazon Web Services, cognitive, Wolfram Alpha, etc. The entire infrastructure that's creating our new sense of meaning. I think that the future lies in cooperation rather than collaboration. I think that the future lies in people being able to define their own benefits and work cooperatively in a network to support each other mutually, sharing freely without expectation of compensation or return, rather than everybody coming into line, collaborating to a single purpose. But it does raise the question, what is the good? What is the benefit that innovation in learning is intended to derive? And I don't think that there's going to be a single answer to it. If you ask me, I would say the benefit of innovation will be something like learning that is context-sensitive, engaging, personal. But that's just me. Your answer might be different. So where's the innovative? We have the drivers. We have the attractors. We have the innovations across the top. We have the black box. What's the value? What's the benefit? Well, I think that contrary to what they say in business and management literature, the truly innovative ideas are not rooted in creating value. And that's heresy. But if you think about innovation in terms of drivers and attractors. The drivers themselves are generally really understood only after the fact. We did it because we had to. And the attractors really, in the end, are created by the innovation. Neither of those, to me, offers a satisfactory explanation of why I, anyways, would innovate. If you ask me, and the fact that I'm here suggests that you have, I would answer it in terms of affordances. I would answer it in terms of making it possible for people to define their own good in their own way and to cooperate with others in exchange for mutual value. If we capture this, we've captured, I think, what is important in innovation. Excuse me. Thank you very much.
Nous allons donner la parole à la salle pour quelques questions et éventuellement aussi on a nos deux blogueuses qui ont la question pour l'instant. Donc le temps est éventuellement de faire quelques questions, peut-être la salle.
Vous pouvez poser vos questions en français, qui seront très vite adaptées à la précédente qui est efficace. Donc même ceux qui ne sont pas des très bons en anglais peuvent se lancer et poser leurs questions. On a deux micros, un de chaque côté de la table. C'était lundi.
That's her, not me. Sure. It's hard to speak and then hear it in my ears. The defining feature of collaboration is that the people engaged in collaboration are working for a single, common, or shared purpose. For example, they might be working toward a single mission, and they might have a shared set of values. They'll certainly have a shared language, shared meanings, and shared intentions. In cooperation, none of this is true. In cooperation, people work toward their own individual objectives, or if you have groups cooperating, each group works towards its own objectives. They may or may not share values. They may or may not share a common language. They may need only enough language that allows them to interact, to communicate. In both collaboration and cooperation, there is an exchange of value. In collaboration, the exchange of value is intended toward the production of the common good. In cooperation, the exchange of value is an exchange of mutual value, supporting each individual interest. So, for example, if I work for a company and they ask me to produce widgets, and maybe they even pay me money, but not very much because that runs against the company, then we're all working toward the shared objective of creating widgets. But if I go to the store and I buy a widget from you, that's not collaboration, that's cooperation. You have something that I want, a widget, I have something that you want, money, and we exchange. A mutual value. And you use your money for whatever you want, and I use my widget for excuse me, whatever I want. Could I get you to bring me my coffee, please? Does that make sense? Was that clear? Sorry about the coughing fit at the end.
Vous parlez de coopération, un bon moyen de coopérer, c'est par exemple que vous avez des innovations. En début de formation, vous avez vu que les innovations étaient apportées à partir du moment où la partie de valeur ajoutée aux enseignements. Il y a un outil qui a été développé dans l'académie de Rennes, par un avancement qui est ici présent, qui permet justement de partager entre enseignants les innovations. Est-ce qu'il existe un outil équivalent au Canada, ou de suite, qui permet à un enseignant de dire voilà, moi, ce que je fais dans ma classe pourrait apporter à d'autres, et donc d'autres pays.
Okay, first of all, yes, I think sharing is a form of cooperation. I personally think it's the best form of cooperation. I'm not really a big fan of marketplace solutions because it creates a whole lot of overhead for something that we could do much more efficiently simply by sharing. I agree that having an exchange where people can share, for example, things that they do well in their class is a type of cooperation. More so, I mean, there are elements of collaboration to it, but really, I see it more as cooperation. You're advancing the benefit of your class, the other people are advancing the benefits of their classes. They may be the same, they may be different, it doesn't matter. Are there tools in Canada? I guess, and I know this will sound cynical, but don't read this as cynical. The tool is the internet, right? The internet is the thing that allows us to share. Some people have proposed over time the idea of specific tools to promote sharing of specific resources. And while I have no particular objection to that, I find it kind of centralized. And I find that when systems become centralized, they become more like systems and less like networks. They tend to become co-opted to produce certain specific results rather than facilitating sharing and cooperation. So I prefer overall a distributed system. Which is why I answer your question, you know, the internet, where each provider of a resource that is being shared provides the mechanism for accessing that resource. They create their own website, or they create their own blogging tool, or their own wiki, or their own repository. And then we use communications mechanisms such as email, HTML, RSS, to access each other's collections.
Oui, en fait, on a deux questions, on n'attend que pour une seule, donc ce qu'on va faire, c'est qu'on va poser les deux questions en une seule. Alors, la première question, c'est repérer et valoriser très loin que l'innovation n'était pas la meilleure manière de l'étouffer. Autrement dit, est-ce que l'innovation n'est pas par nature transgressive et donc souterraine? Et la deuxième question, c'est une personne qui aimerait savoir.
Sorry, I missed the first question, it didn't come through on the translator.
Alors, on la reprend, c'est parti. Repérer et valoriser pour promouvoir l'innovation, est-ce que c'est pas la meilleure manière de l'étouffer? Autrement dit, est-ce que l'innovation n'est pas par nature transgressive et donc souterraine?
Is innovation by nature transgressive or underground?
Voilà. Et la deuxième, une personne qui voudrait savoir comment vous imaginez la place de l'enseignant dans une classe coopérative à l'avenir. Une passe du sage on the stage au dit on the stage. Et demain, alors, que va faire l'enseignant?
Okay. Lovely questions.
Une minute pour répondre.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I agree that innovation is underground and transgressive. That's where the best innovation is. And I find that when innovation is promoted as a value, the benefit that is to be obtained is often a benefit for whomever is promoting the innovation, rather than whomever is creating the innovation. But true innovation isn't about preserving the existing system necessarily. It's often about redistribution, it's often about reorganization, it's often about revitalization, and therefore not necessarily in the interests of those who were originally producing the demand for innovation. But I think that we're in an environment now where both forms prevail, where there is a managerial imperative toward innovation, largely because many existing structures are showing flaws and weaknesses. And there's an imperative on the part of individuals to innovate in order to, as I would put it, create a fairer and more just society. The expression guide on the side and sage on the stage comes from the overall transition from instructivist and behaviorist modes of teaching to constructivist modes of teaching. And there's a lot to be said in favor of constructivism, and I won't do the whole history here. And they get a lot of things right. But I am not a constructivist. I'm not an instructivist either, but I am not a constructivist for a variety of reasons. I don't believe that we learn by creating representations or mental models. I think that the phrase making meaning is vacuous and unhelpful. I believe that learning is a type of growth. It is not the acquiring of content, but rather the change of state internally through a process of activity, exchange, and interaction. And this growth is facilitated through the presentation of models, of methods, of sources of inspiration. So I see the role of the instructor not as a sage on the stage, but nor either the guide on the side. I see the role of the instructor as the person who should be instantiating the best practices that the student will and ought to want to emulate over time. So, in a classroom, I see the role of the teacher as the chief learner. I see the role of the teacher as someone who explores and discovers and creates and shows how to do these things and does them with their students. That's different from instructing, it's different from coaching. I don't think that the teacher should step back. I think that the teacher should lead through example, through being somebody that you really want to emulate. That's my view on that. Okay. Thank you very much.
That's very interesting for everybody here.
François Trou, du Centre de recherche sur la formation. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much, Stéphane.
Thank you.
Thank you.